And then some showers tomorrow.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Step back in time to 1924 and British Palestine. Arabs, Jews, and British overlords chase different dreams in one land. Pith helmets, Zionists, and mullahs collide. Fast forward to 2003, and it's the Americans who play the overlord. Arabs and Jews remained locked in battle. The roots of today's conflict are laid out in Jonathan Wilson's new novel, A Palestine Affair. Shifting sands, shifting loves, shifting truths. Tonight, On Point, a passage to old Palestine. Novelist Jonathan Wilson and A Palestine Affair. We begin tonight with a check-in on the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace in Israel. 1 week ago, President Bush was expressing optimism in the Middle East, but violence has returned. Today, Israeli helicopters launched 2 strikes at Palestinian targets, killing 5 people and wounding the number 2 man in Hamas, Abdel Aziz Rantisi. Israel said the strikes were retaliation for a Palestinian attack that killed 4 Israeli soldiers on Sunday. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem bureau chief for the Financial Times. I asked him where the roadmap process stands now.
I think it's still there. The process still goes forward. The important thing, I think, is that President Bush is committed to it because everybody on both sides agrees that it's the American involvement that is going to make this thing either work or collapse. He seems to be determined that he's going to get something out of this. But it was always predicted that those elements on both sides who are not happy with the direction of the roadmap would do their best to upset it, and I think that's what we're seeing now.
Harvey Morris, President Bush put out today that he was, quote, deeply troubled by the Israeli helicopter attack. But what does that mean, and how will that be received in Israel? What's the impact of a statement like that?
He's made critical statements of Israel in the past. You know, he's told them to withdraw when they've entered Palestinian territory. This time round, I think he's very keen to be seen to be even-handed, and he's very keen to be seen not to be pursuing this process in the interest purely of Israel, which, of course, is the view that's put forward among the Palestinians and in the Arab world. Now, what the Israelis say is, well, once President Bush realizes what a bad guy this was that we were trying to hit, then he will come around to our way of looking at things. There's a little bit of Israeli spin there because obviously one must assume that the Americans are perfectly aware of the sort of people they're dealing with on the Palestinian side, and that when he made his statement that he was deeply worried about developments, it must have been within the full knowledge of who the target of this assassination attempt was.
And Harvey, what's the sense there tonight? Are we back into the cycle of attack and counterattack? And if we are, how does the peace process endure?
Well, I think we may risk going into a cycle now because the thing about the attempt to assassinate Mr. Rantisi is that he's a member of the political wing of Hamas. Now, this is a distinction which maybe is more important to the militants themselves than it is to us. But the Israelis have been quite careful in the past to target military leaders of the militant groups rather than the sort of public faces of those groups, such as Mr. Rantisi. So it's an escalation on their part. There are other things going on here as well. I mean, the Israelis are beginning to pull down these isolated settlement outposts, which is their response to the roadmap. And that's created a lot of unrest on the right wing. It may be that this operation against Mr. Rantisi will enable Mr. Sharon to say to his right wing, look, although I'm doing things that you don't like, at least I'm continuing to fight terrorism.
But Rantisi said from his hospital bed after the attack in which he and others were wounded, said, we will continue our holy war and resistance until every last criminal Zionist is evicted from this land. How does Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian prime minister, bridge this gap now? How does he bring a unified front behind a peaceful approach to the Palestinian camp? Or are we on a path towards some kind of internal conflict, even armed, among the Palestinians?
What Mr. Abbas has said to Hamas and the other groups is that even though they don't agree with the course on which he has embarked, that as Muslims and as Palestinians, they should go along with him. They should at least allow him to see the process through. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But that they should avoid, wherever possible, an internal Palestinian civil war. And that is the main strength of his appeal at the moment. Now, it looked as if that might be a possibility. Hamas was studying the latest comments that he'd made. This assassination attempt has rather blown a hole in that. But I think that that will be the policy that he will attempt to pursue.
Harvey, it seems that there are real hopes, but also there's some posing going on, perhaps all round in this process. In your view, what's real and what is empty theater in this roadmap peace process?
I think the problem is that most Palestinians think that the destination of the roadmap will not be enough to satisfy their aspirations. In other words, the state that is being contemplated is a very pale shadow of what they think they should have as a Palestinian state. And therefore, a lot of people are not prepared to even embark on this course. Mahmoud Abbas has decided that he's going to go down the road that's been decreed because he recognizes the influence of the United States in the Middle East. He can't defy George Bush. So therefore, he will do his best to make this thing work. But I don't think there's a great deal of optimism on the Palestinian side that the end result is really going to resolve the overall conflict.
Harvey Morris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Harvey Morris is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Gaza. No two people look at a painting in exactly the same way. Novelist Jonathan Wilson uses the painter's canvas as a metaphor for colliding realities of 1924 British Palestine. His new novel, A Palestine Affair, is, says the Washington Post, a murder mystery that's less about who done it than it is about why its characters came to Palestine in the first place. There is passion here, and dreams, and illusion, manipulation, and deceit. Sounds like today's headlines, but in sepia tones and older times. It's summertime, and we're welcoming books back to On Point. In the next week, we'll be talking with Jane Smiley, Jonathan Schell, and Erica Jong. Tonight, it's Jonathan Wilson, 1920s Palestine, and a question put by a character in his new novel, can anything that starts badly, a love, a career, a nation, ever be put right? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Jonathan Wilson, author of A Palestine Affair. Good evening and welcome to On Point, Jonathan Wilson.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's great to have you. I've read the book and enjoyed it enormously. So much resonance in 1924 with all the imagery that you bring to mind from that period. It's still the great age of the British Imperial Age and much younger time in the conflict between Jews and Arabs, and yet so much that echoes right through to today. I want you to begin to take us into the story so that our listeners can have a sense of what this great canvas is filled with. But I think it'd be good first if you'd kind of set the stage historically. Put us back in 1924. We know, or we think we know from headlines, what Israel and the West Bank and Gaza are today. But put us back in 1924, that moment in time, that place in history where your novel, A Palestine Affair, is set.
Well, I think the first thing to remember or realize is that we're dealing with a very small population compared to the population that's there now. The population of Jerusalem in the census of 1922 was documented as 62,500. So this is the size
of a tiny burg.
This is like a smaller than an American suburb.
But it's still Jerusalem.
It's still Jerusalem. The population of Amman was 15,000 in Transjordan in 1924. We're 6 years after the end of the First World War. The British are running the place. The British administration has a number of high-ranking British Jewish members mm-hmm. who are trying to act in an impartial way and are getting it from both sides.
From the Brits, who you describe as having a kind of a natural ingrained anti-Semitism very often, if I don't mischaracterize, and from Zionists who don't want to see Jews playing an impartial role for the overlord here.
Right, and from the Arab population who thinks that the British Jews are naturally inclining to help the local Jewish population.
Because they're already seeing the fight that's shaping up over this land quite clearly.
Yes, I mean, we have a sort of more than nascent Zionist movement that's already fairly well established, and perhaps the beginnings of a kind of Palestinian nationalism, although that's a little more shadowy or underground at this point.
The British had inherited Palestine, so to speak, from the defeated Turks at the end of World War I.
Yes.
And so this is not exactly the jewel in the crown of the British Empire.
No, it's more an outpost of the empire. But one of the interesting things about it is I think people don't really think of Palestine as a place where the empire enacted itself in the way that, say, it did in India. But in fact, it did in a sort of fascinating way. The British went duck shooting in Palestine. They went fox hunting, only there were no foxes, so they hunted jackal in the Galilee. They went duck shooting in the Galilee. They held gymkhanas. They had tea at 4 in the afternoon. They dressed inappropriately. All those
and the pith helmets were there, and the grand white costume for the governor and the parties. The whole the British took their great trunks with them when they traveled. The great trunks of the imperial. And into that, you place the sort of grains of sand that turn into the pearl of the novel here. Give us the basics. We're going to explore this as the hour goes on, but the kind of the fundamental outline of the story that you place here.
Well, the catalyst is a murder that I actually based on what in Israel is quite a famous case, which is not well known outside of Israel, which is in 1924, a Dutch Jew, Jacob Israel de Haan, who in my transformation of him is called de Groot, was murdered outside the Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. I shift the venue of that too.
He's a journalist turned Orthodox Jew.
He'd come out as a secular Zionist, and he had oddly, or perhaps not oddly, if one believes all the talk about the Jerusalem syndrome, he had transformed himself into an ultra-Orthodox Jew, and of the lobbyist for the anti-Zionist ultra-Orthodox Agudat Israel movement.
You're saying we don't want this nation of Israel.
Right.
At the same time, he's carrying along a kind of line of homoerotic poetry that becomes somewhat.
Yes, he was a poet, and the homoerotic part was probably clouded by him and by his readers.
But de Groot, who's based on this man who existed in history, dies very early
he's
in
murdered,
the book.
Yes.
He falls into the garden of a British painter and his American wife, who is kind of inexplicably at first an ardent Zionist, though not Jewish.
Right. And the inexplicably was one of the things that I wanted to grapple with, because I was thinking of her in the same way that one might think of, say, Laurie Berenson, if you remember, the young American woman who got involved with the Shining Path guerrillas and is now in jail in Peru. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, well, what happens to people when they get involved in a fight that is not, on the surface anyway, their fight? You know, why do you get involved with the Shining Path guerrillas? What's it got to do with you? And the same with this young woman, Joyce, who's an American who's wound up in London, but who has become, as people do, romantically, philosophically, ideologically connected to a movement, a group, a people.
The magnetic power, that vision, that dream.
Yeah, that you become attached to and very passionately. The irony, of course, is that her husband, who is Jewish, has no interest in Zionism whatsoever.
Couldn't care less, at least at the outset. And, and maybe even at the end, one of the most fascinating parts about your book, A Palestine Affair, the very different ways in which different Jews respond to the situation in Israel, not to mention Americans, British, Arabs, and all the players, and of course the young American woman who ends up at some point being described as, I think, a Zionist terrorist before your book is over. We are talking tonight with novelist Jonathan Wilson about his new novel, A Palestine Affair, a story set in the passion, deceit, and violence of 1920s Palestine that still resonates today. You can join this conversation. What is it that draws so many minds and feet to Palestine, even now? Is there a truth in Palestine, in Israel, or just a welter of prejudice, illusion, dreams, manipulation, deceit? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with novelist Jonathan Wilson about his new novel, A Palestine Affair. It's a story set in 1920s, British Mandate Palestine. Lots of passion, lots of deceit, some critical violence, a story that resonates with the headlines even today. You can join the conversation tonight. Is there one truth in Palestine, in Israel, on the West Bank, in Gaza, or just a welter of prejudice, illusion, dreams, hopes, manipulation, deceit? And is America the new imperial Britain in the Middle East, conflicted, naive, even doomed to fail? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Wilson, you've got to set here with the beginning of this story where the couple is there, the British painter, Jewish, the American wife, not Jewish, but Zionist, the dead Orthodox Jew who falls into their garden, into their very arms with a dagger through his heart, and all the presumptions that come out of that. We'll get into those. But give us a flavor of the Jerusalem that you describe in A Palestine Affair. I wonder if you could read for us just a bit, maybe from page 130, if you've got that.
Sure. The heat wave of the last few days, driven by hot winds from the desert, had passed through, and now the air was fresh and warm. The garden, pristine in light and settled under a clear sky, nevertheless had a nice English country clutter and disorder about it. The grass was high, and there was hyssop growing in unruly abundance out of the stone walls. On either side of the door, pink mallow sprouted from used tins of olive oil. For the first time, Kirsch thought he understood why Jews from around the world might want to live here, although he was aware that his reasons for thinking so, which had nothing to do with politics or persecution or religion or history, and everything to do with plant, sun, sex, and love, were probably out of line with the majority opinion. He let Joyce know some part of what was on his mind, but, as usual, she was severe with him. "From what you're saying, you might as well be in Italy, or any Mediterranean country with a nice climate, pretty flowers, and brightly coloured birds flitting about. Don't you have any sympathy for the Zionists? I mean, they're not asking for very much, considering what the Jews have given to the world, and without, I might add, having received a lot of thank yous. You don't have to lecture me. I am a Jew, remember? Well, you don't act like one. And how does a Jew act? With pride and allegiance, I would hope. Zionist pride? You could do a lot worse. What's so wonderful about being English? Well, I suppose you must love it. You get to police the empire."
Jonathan Wilson, reading from his new novel, A Palestine Affair, and that pleasure of policing the empire turns out to be bittersweet at the very best in Palestine. It's an interesting passage because it's rather early in the book, and things are being described, you know, plants, sun, sex, and love. It breaks down quite dramatically and quite quickly. It's not long before we have the young American, the Zionist, Joyce. You describe her looking at the desolate hills. They looked like skeletons of places that had once been green. How could anyone call this a land of milk and honey? And her husband, Bloomberg, thinking to himself, between the Jews who were staying and those who were only passing through, there was always this slight awkwardness, he thought. The reason, he suspected, was that no one was ever quite sure to which group they belong, if they were Jews who were staying or Jews who were just passing through. We'll follow the story along, but give us a little of your personal history, Jonathan. You're kind of uniquely positioned to write this book. I mean, it's maybe less surprising that it came from you. You're British by birth and upbringing. You spent years in Israel. You spent years in America as well, and you've got some good tweaks in here for Americans. But how is your biography flowing out in A Palestine Affair?
Well, I imagine that it has something to do with precisely the sort of mixed identity that you describe. I mean, I wouldn't want to psych out myself too deeply, and I imagine that my imagination does that for me in what it presents in this novel. But also I think that my family background played into this. In other words, my father, who was 18 in 1924, born in England in 1906, mm-hmm. Who was not a Zionist at all, but was a very observant and Orthodox Jew, not opposed to Israel on the ultra-Orthodox ground that it was somehow a blasphemous place and mm-hmm. shouldn't exist, but simply thought that he could live life as a very assimilated English Jew, although there were other members of my family who thought that his position was naive. I suppose that my own going backwards and forwards, later in the century, mirror some of the sort of larger movements that were occurring earlier in the century. I mean, a lot of people, for example, the great Hebrew writer and Israeli Nobel Prize winner S.Y. Agnon, went to Palestine and went back to Europe and then back to Palestine and back to Europe. There was a lot
struggling
of
struggling with themselves.
Struggling, exactly.
Where do I belong?
Precisely.
If I'm Jewish, must I be in Palestine? Or if I'm assimilated, yes. Why not be anywhere else?
Yes, and all this is fascinating stuff, of course, because it comes before the Holocaust. So that part of the discussion that seems to say, well, the Holocaust changes everything in understanding this, it's much more complex before this has occurred.
I have to say, your book really brought that to life for me. I mean, the kind of contemporary mythology of Israel is so much connected with the Holocaust. There was the Holocaust, therefore, there must be and was Israel. But here is this root ball deep beneath that horrible event, and already this deep yearning, deep
yes,
longing.
Much earlier and very complicated in the sense that, for example, while the majority population in Palestine was Arab significantly, the majority population in Jerusalem was Jewish and has significantly.
Even by 1924?
Oh, by 1924 there were 50,000 Jews in Jerusalem.
50,000 out of the 60,000 population that you described?
By 1924, it was probably a little over.
A couple of years later.
Yeah, a couple of years later. So 50,000 Jews, 15,000 Christians, and only 10,000 Arabs in Jerusalem.
Wow.
So again, it's not a clear-cut situation. Joyce at one point thinks, it seems to her that by the numbers anyway, Palestine should belong to the Arabs, but it seems to her, for reasons that are, again, complicated to do with her character, axiomatic that actually it shouldn't. It should belong to the Jews. And even if you look at the numbers, you don't get the clear picture that one might hope to get in wanting to decipher, how to interpret this place.
One of the fascinating things is you describe how that lack of a clear picture was very much alive, is very much alive in the pages of A Palestine Affair, and very much used, manipulated by all parties. Everyone seems to be playing at least a double game here. When the Orthodox Jewish man ends up with the knife in his chest in the garden, the very quick assumptions go to a young Arab boy as the killer. But of course, it's not nearly that simple, and you quickly get into uncovering the deep tensions between Jews themselves at that time, let alone between Arabs and Jews, and the British and Jews and British Jews and other Jews. I wonder, in all that, how your perspective as Britain-born comes into play. I mean, there's throughout the book this sense that, however assimilated Jews may be in Britain, that there's always this undertow, this edge of anti-Semitism that makes them feel, well, maybe I should be looking to Palestine, to Israel as my place. Maybe I'm never really accepted there.
Well, it was certainly part of my experience growing up. And I certainly felt an underlying, or fairly actually on the surface, anti-Semitism in aspects of my experience growing up in England. Although I have to say I have two older brothers, and I don't think that they would agree with me, that they always felt far more at home in England than I did. When I first came to New York, which was in 1976, I had the most wonderful time, and I think it was because I felt it was the first time in my life I'd ever seen Jewish people having fun. And the other part of it was precisely because I didn't feel that my Jewishness mattered very much.
It was just ambient.
Exactly, in the same way that I actually felt when I lived in Jerusalem. In England, I felt that it always mattered. It always came up in conversation in some kind of sometimes grotesque fashion, but it was always present. It was always an issue. Certainly, I felt that when I was a student in Oxford, and I never felt that way since I've been in the United States. I mean, that, okay, one can be Jewish, but it doesn't have that sort of odd aspect that it seems to contain in Europe.
But both your painter here and Kirsch, who is the British policeman and Jew, who is assigned to this case and ends up becoming a lover with the American Zionist Joyce, both of them are very arm's length about the whole Palestinian Zionist project. I mean, they're very ambivalent about it. What have you come to believe about why some Jews, some people, just find this irresistible and others pass through, skim on, and are gone?
Well, that's a very hard question to answer, and I'm not sure that I can even answer it for myself, because I think over a lifetime one experiences a range of sort of pulls and tugs in different directions. And one of the things that I wanted to do in the novel was, through the variety of characters that I present, indeed present versions of those different pulls and tugs, and that aren't always the predictable ones. In other words, just as Kirsch, who has sort of no political acumen, somehow falls in love with the place and is transformed by it, how you can attach yourself to an ideology when you really have no basis for getting interested in that ideology. Well, you know, in other words, things don't work in a clear-cut fashion. That Joyce falls in love with the romance of these meetings, Zionist meetings in Toynbee Hall in 1923, and then the ideology comes second.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Whereas for Kirsch, it's sort of the other way around. Whereas other people like Mayan, who is the Russian immigrant, would seem to have a more solid and predictable base in why she's there, because of persecution. But I didn't want because of persecution to be the only reason to explain why people were attracted to Palestine. And I think you come back in that sense to the sort of Laurie Berenson mode. Okay? You know, why The Shining Path? You know, and there are many,
a blazing dream that just draws people in.
Yes, yes.
And not everyone wants to latch into that dream.
Right, and when that dream touches reality, you either refuse to see the reality or...
Because it's not all beautiful, it's not all pure, it's not all just or even right, necessarily.
Precisely.
Listeners, we're talking with Jonathan Wilson, author of the new novel, A Palestine Affair. He describes haunting ethical complexities and clashing motivations in 1924 Palestine. Are they any less today? And there's this. His painter, Mark Bloomberg, asks in A Palestine Affair if anything that starts out badly, a love, a career, a nation, can ever be put right. What answer does Palestine suggest? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jake is calling from Alston, Massachusetts. Hi, Jake. You're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Ashbrook. Tremendous program. I have a couple of ethical conundrums for the author. One of the things in the history of the Jewish movement in Palestine has been the definition of the word terrorist. When Britain was the imperial power, hello?
Yes, we're here.
When Britain was the imperial power, the Jewish freedom fighters like the Haganah and the Stern Gang were really labeled by the imperial powers that be of those days as terrorists. And we are aware of several leading Jewish leaders who were actually killed or hanged by the British because of various alleged terrorist incidents.
Yeah, there's some rough history there, and we know it. Where are you taking us, Chip?
Well, now look at how the definition of the terrorists in the same area has changed. And what I'm calling attention to is how fluid the concept of terrorism and a terrorist has been. It really depend on which dominant power is doing the defining rather than anything inherent in what a terrorist does for self-determination.
It's a question that comes up again and again around the world these days, but it seems perpetually in Israel, the West Bank, Gaza. Jake, thanks for calling in. Jonathan Wilson, you're in a Palestine affair, you're by no means black and white here. The kind of mantle of rectitude is a very slippery one in this book. At one point, you describe Joyce, the American Zionist. You say her hopeful American face and lively gray-green eyes, the very picture of a Zionist terrorist, life was mad. In the book, you're not afraid to put that right on her, but it is a mantle that moves around.
Yeah, I don't want to give too much of the plot away in regard to Joyce at the end there, but I did want to relate to the quote that you had before about things starting, but can something that starts badly ever be put right? And I think that you know what we might think about in that regard is Ireland as a hopeful, and that seems to me the parallel situation with Palestine, where there's this deep history of a conflict that just seems absolutely unresolvable.
So sitting here tonight, you're sunnier than your character Mark Bloomberg is sitting in Jerusalem in 1924. You're more optimistic? Is that what I'm hearing? Really?
Well,
you see what's happened just in the last couple of days.
If we'd have talked about Ireland 5 years ago, would anybody have been optimistic? I mean, that seems to me the hope. If you think of something like a poem like Yeats's Meditation in the Time of Civil War, which really ends with him suggesting that somehow sweetness can come out of violence, that the violence will end in sweetness, which I think was probably naive and romantic of him. But I think that dream has to persist, that at some point the violence will end and be replaced by a kind of sweetness. And that seems to be happening in Ireland, where one would have imagined absolutely impossible.
But what about Jake's larger point about the powers that be being the party that determines who's a terrorist and who's something else? I mean, this gets to,
yes,
you know, righteous violence, violence that's wrong. You wrestle with this in a Palestine affair.
Yes, certainly. I mean, the novel does not shy away from the fact that what is essentially a terrorist act or political assassination is at the heart of it. And one of the things that, of course, inspired the novel was the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. This is what turned me back to the Dahan affair.
By a hard-right, disturbed young Jewish man.
And there was a lot of discussion at the time about how unique this was and how unprecedented that that a Jew would politically assassinate another Jew. And
your novel shouts, no way!
Well, history is uglier than that, yes, and more complicated, and that we can't cover over those ugly things if we're to understand what how things began and how we got to the point that we're at now.
A Palestine affair gets to some pretty sticky points before it all wraps up. We're talking with novelist Jonathan Wilson tonight about his new novel, A Palestine Affair. It's set in 1924 Jerusalem, and the elements really resonate today. What is it that draws so many minds and feet to Palestine even now, to this place, to this story? Is there a truth in Palestine, in Israel, or a welter of prejudice, illusion, dreams, manipulation, deceit? And is America, the new imperial Britain in the Middle East, conflicted, naive, maybe doomed to fail, maybe something else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
r.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with novelist Jonathan Wilson about his new novel, A Palestine Affair. It's set in 1924 Jerusalem over the space of just a few weeks. There's a murder, there's an investigation, there's a cover-up, there are deliberate false allegations about who murdered whom. And there is a glimpse into the conflicts that are way down in the root ball of the life of Palestine, everything that is Palestine today, Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, the Arabs, the Jews, and the foreign, in that day, British, and perhaps today American, overlord. Jonathan Wilson describes that haunting ethical complexities, clashing motivations in 1924 Palestine. Are they any less today? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. talk. And just a clarification, we talked a couple of times about Lori Berenson and the allure that she found in Peru, or at least in the popular mythology. We should be careful to note there that she was not associated or accused of associating specifically with Shining Path, but there was another revolutionary group in Peru called the MRTA. Of course, a sad story in its own right. Jonathan Wilson, I wondered if you'd read another bit for us. You have a piece here, page 152, that describes how in Palestine, then and now, things can deteriorate so quickly, from friction of different groups rubbing against one another to just a kind of sad hell on earth.
It started, if you can believe this, over an errant whack at a football in a village outside Jerusalem. A Jewish boy kicked it into an Arab family's tomato patch. A little girl grabbed the ball and hid it in a pile of laundry. When the boy came to retrieve his ball, the girl started screaming. Out comes her father, or maybe it was her brother, with an iron rod and smashes the boy's skull. Well, in these parts, as I'm sure you know, it's all an eye for an eye. So 2 hours later, there's a young Arab boy out taking a stroll, and suddenly he's getting smacked on the head with a blunt instrument. News spreads into the city, and by nightfall, everybody was going at it in the area by the Wailing Wall. Luckily for Bobby, he was already in the hospital, because the district commissioner sent in 10 chaps in steel helmets to take on 400 Jews and Arabs going crazy, and only one of the policemen managed to escape a wound.
And there it is. No fun. That's
an actual incident that occurred, by the way.
It is.
Yeah, a couple of years later.
It's a ball in the tomato patch, and pretty soon people
are
dying.
That's absolutely as it occurred in Jerusalem, not in 24, but about 4 years later, and I moved it back. And
Jonathan, you know Britain, you know America, you know Israel. When you look out at the role that the British played in the Palestinian the mandate in 1920s Palestine, you look at the more tentative, more arm's length, but very much enmeshed role that the United States plays today. What parallels do you see? What distinctions do you draw?
I think perhaps the closer parallel is with the United States in Iraq at the moment, because they are actually there and they are essentially running the place. And
they're chasing the soccer balls into tomato patches in Baghdad.
Precisely, and are trying to bring together warring groups without perhaps the deepest knowledge that you can get of precisely what you're doing or precisely what those groups are going to do. And the arm's length version that we have right now with the Bush administration in Israel, I think we see in the last couple of days just how difficult it is, that everything seems to be going along just fine, and then each side does something sort of radically stupid.
But you quote or you have that the British, is it Governor in the book, say, hey, it's simple. You know, you hand out a soccer ball here and you give a stroke there, and it's simple. You get everything lined up. You get the hair of this unruly society combed right, and it'll work. Don't worry. Was that the British conceit? Is that an American conceit today?
Yes, I think it is. But when you're dealing with religion, it's never simple. That's the lesson. And it's never rational. One of the interesting sort of topsy-turvy aspects of the relationship between my novel and now is that the virulently anti-Zionist, ultra-Orthodox Jewish group Agudat Israel, as it was in 1924,
opposing
the state of Israel, now has Uri Lupolianski, who is the acting mayor of Jerusalem. And that party is about to have a significant representative, probably very shortly, as the mayor of Jerusalem. So things can turn over time.
But in that day, they were appealing even to Downing Street.
Yes.
Saying, stop this.
Yes.
Stop everything that's happening. Stop the violence. Stop everything that's coming into this country that's going to lead us to the state of Israel and to a calamity, as they saw it. Then now They're saying, don't dismantle those settlements. And
precisely. Although there, of course, still are ultra-Orthodox groups in Israel who do not support the Zionist state, although they are protected by them.
Your painter ends up in the deserts in Transjordan, out at Petra.
Yeah.
On a kind of his 40 days and nights in the desert, a little of a kind of passage to India feeling there. At the same time, on the other hand, I'm feeling sort of Jean Le Carré with Joyce's turn, the kind of drummer girl turn to Zionism. But everyone really feeling their way, and always this sense of a kind of central mystery of what is this place, Palestine? What are we to make of it? How are we to react with it? Many different responses to that mystery.
And particularly Jerusalem as this sort of spiritual omphalos for more or less everybody. But of course I wanted to chuck in there this rather secular painter for whom his easel is his home, and wherever he is. I mean, he's come out to Jerusalem on a Zionist commission to paint girls in bloomers working in the swamps. He doesn't want to do it. He gets taken up by the governor of the city, who pays him a lot more money to produce conservative renditions of the Christian sites.
Because, of course, the British want to refurbish Jerusalem into
and they did.
Picture of their mind's eye, the old city in all its grandeur. They make it that with something.
Yes, and they did. And I mean, again, an interesting comparison perhaps with the U.S. in Iraq at the moment. I mean, most of the building codes that are currently operating in Israel come from the British under the mandate. Mm.
We've got a bunch of callers here. Peter's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I purchased the book this morning, and I was reading it in a coffee shop.
Great.
And within a half an hour, I said to myself, where have I smelled these stones before? The ambience and the congress of people with people.
What did it bring to mind, Peter?
Alexandria Quartet. All the deceit and the harmonies and the
Lawrence Durrell.
Yes. And I was wondering if Durrell had influenced him at all just over the years.
It's a great question, Peter. Jonathan Wilson.
The truth is that I actually haven't read any of the Alexandria Quartet, although I remember my brother had it on his shelves when I was growing up. So
I mean, I have to say, having read some of your own work, Jonathan, that there is a line from your earlier work, The Hiding Room, here, which was more centered in Egypt, but spilled over as well, that sense of exploring history for meaning here in Israel, in Palestine.
I'm somehow taken back there, and the place haunts my imagination in various ways. Some of my stories are set in more contemporary Israel, but somehow in my novels I'm drawn back to the past. Mm.
Andy's calling from Boston. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Earlier, a caller raised an interesting point about the shifting definition of terrorism, sort of equating the early sort of Jewish activity against the British with current terrorism by the Palestinians against Israeli and Jewish civilians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems to me a big component of any sort of that extreme action is incitement. And I was wondering if the author, if you want to go that way and try to make it an equivalency, did he ever witness or research any sort of incitement among Jews towards Arab civilians, or was it mainly a...
Do you mean in history? Do you mean
historical, was there... right, in the early 20s or so? My understanding is that pretty much most of the military action was directed against the British restrictions towards Jewish immigration.
Got it, Andy. I think our time's running down, but here's this question of who's the actor, who's acted upon, when is it terrorism, when is it not? But the specific question here, was there incitement by Jews toward British or Arabs, I guess, at that time?
I don't think there was much incitement that early, but there were certainly all kinds of little incidents all over the place.
That's how you define incitement, I guess.
Right.
I mean, there was a Zionist dream that the Arabs could well have imagined as being in conflict with their lives, as they had known.
Certainly, and there was a horrible massacre in Jaffa that I fictionalize in the novel, where new Jewish arrivals were massacred
and mowed down.
Yes, but that particular aspect wasn't what was engaging me so fully in this novel. I was interested in the relationship between Jews and Jews, I think, and between Jews and Brits, which is, I suppose, a way of saying I carved myself up.
Our time is short here, but there's a point in your In the book, in A Palestine Affair, where one Jew says to another, uses the word we. And the other Jew responds, we, with a big question mark. What lies in that question mark?
Well, I think you're talking about a point where actually it's a conversation between a British Jew and an American Jew, and the American Jew is saying, I know who you are. Mm-hmm. And the British Jew is saying, you have nothing to do with me. You're an American. So these are sort of irrepressible and irresolvable and fascinating messes.
There they are. Jonathan Wilson, it's a wonderful book and a great read, and we thank you for coming in tonight. Jonathan Wilson, novelist and author of the new book, A Palestine Affair. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. This is On Point. Having lived in Northern Ireland for more than two decades, poet Chris Agee is no stranger to conflict and violence. His second collection of poems, First Light, published 2 months ago, deals with his experience in two war-torn areas of the world, his Northern Ireland homeland and the Balkans, where he spent time in the immediate aftermath of the Bosnian War. Agee is one of four writers from international conflict zones who have been traveling the country since April, reading from their works as part of a program directed by the William Joyner Center for the Study of War and Social Consequences at UMass Boston. Here, Agee reads a poem he wrote as he visited a mass grave in Kosovo about a month after the violence there ended, a grave that contained the bodies of an entire clan that had been slaughtered in the war.
Mass grave, Padalista. A tiny mound. Nine fresh graves, for the second time in 2 days, in the killing fields, in her tears. It was clear that little Afrin, commemorated on the hill behind, had been buried here. Mother and father, his six sisters in a row, narrowing to his five-year-old smallness. The whole Imre clan, whose names and ages I had just jotted down in sight of their cousins' graves down a grassy knoll, tape fluttering. A lone trainer on the rise, still cloying the air with the sickly Swedish dead flesh reek yesterday's Spanish had unearthed. I am sweating. Dust has coated my boots. I have followed the others down a highway bend to this gash of earth on a verge of thorny pasturage, on from the abstract pathos of the wooden sign where I have felt plunged into the inward isobar of a sudden profundity, August in Krasova. This hour's whole archipelago of beauty and terror that felt burnt like some high kingdom of the moment through the ozone of consciousness, where Moop, secret police, had descended from the passes to Serbia like mountainous evil in a Finnish epic, where Abraham might have slaughtered his seed. We stand before the simple fact in silence, eyes meeting, catastrophe murmured in Albanian. I squat, fingering the clods as if touching his tragedy, thinking somehow of his boy's perspirant brow, how much he was loved, the unbelievableness of sinking a bullet like a sink head into the same skull. Rising, inner tears, as if the inner was tearing, listening to the crunch inside of our steps on the dirt road towards the burnt houses and rolling uplands where their lives ended, where high hay is aflush with wild flowers and luminescence, where sleepers of shadow dapple the road. Picking up on the way back from the clods, a bit of jumper blanched like a dish rag's threads. From a thorn near Afrin's mound, a shoelace tied to plastic twine. From a few paces, a scrap of sock.
Irish poet Chris Agee reading his poem Mass Grave, Padalista, a volume of Agee's Balkan essays titled Journey to Bosnia, will be published later this year. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is WB.